Welcome back, my friend. Oh my, we are 8 episodes into the story of Perseus. I had no idea it would take this long to tell. I'm glad you have stuck with it. I watched them fly home that day, Perseus and Andromeda, crossing the water towards Seriphos with those borrowed winged sandals beating against the wind. Her arms were around him, her dark hair streaming behind them both, and the sea below caught the afternoon light like hammered bronze. It should have been beautiful, and it was. Gods, it was. But I could feel the tension coming off Perseus like heat from a stone that's been in the sun too long. His whole body was rigid, his eyes fixed on that little rocky island growing larger on the horizon. Andromeda felt it too. She turned her head, tried to catch his eye, asked him something I couldn't quite hear over the wind. He shook his head. "I don't know," he said. "I just don't know." But he did know. Not in words, maybe. Not in facts, but the way you know a storm is coming before you see the clouds. That deep animal certainty that something is wrong. I've watched a lot of homecomings over the years. Odysseus, Agamemnon, countless others whose names you've never heard. And I'll tell you something. They're never what you imagine while you're away. You picture the faces, the embraces, everything returning to the way it was. But here's the truth. You're not the way you were. And home doesn't freeze in time waiting for you to get back. It shifts. It changes. Sometimes it betrays you while you're gone. Perseus had left Seriphos as a boy, trying to prove something to a king who didn't deserve the effort. He was coming back as someone who'd done the impossible. Cut off a gorgon's head, turned a titan to stone, freed a princess from chains. He'd crossed half the known world and survived things that should have killed him a dozen times over. But all he really wanted was to see his mother safe. Dana. I've always loved her, you know. Loved her courage, her fierce gentleness. She was the whole reason Perseus took that cursed quest in the first place. King Polydectes wanted to marry her, wanted to possess her, really. And Perseus stood in the way. Just a young man with nothing but his pride and his love for his mother saying no to a king. So Polydectes sent him after Medusa's head. Called it a wedding gift, a chance for glory. It was really just murder with better manners. What Polydectes didn't know, what he couldn't have known, was that some mortals are touched by fate. That the gods, fickle and strange as we are, sometimes decide to help. That Perseus was Zeus's son, whether Zeus bothered to claim him or not. The island grew closer. I could see Perseus's hands tighten on the straps of that leather bag he carried. Inside it, wrapped in cloth upon cloth, was Medusa's head. Still dangerous. Still deadly. Even severed from her body. He was bringing it home like a gift. Like a weapon. Like an answer to a question Polydectes should never have asked. I knew what he was going to find when he landed. I'd been watching Seriphos while he was gone. Watching Polydectes grow bolder. Watching Danae run out of places to hide. But I'm not going to tell you yet. You need to see it the way Perseus saw it. With all the shock and fury and relief hitting him at once. The winged sandals touched down near the Temple of Athena, just above the harbor. Perseus steadied Andromeda as her feet found solid ground, and for a moment they both just stood there, breathing hard, adjusting to stillness after so much flight. That's when I saw Dictys come running from the temple entrance. Dictys, the fisherman who'd found Danae and baby Perseus floating in that wooden chest all those years ago. The man who'd pulled them from the sea and raised the boy as his own, asking nothing in return. One of those rare mortals who make me think there's hope for humanity after all. His face when he saw Perseus. Oh, I'll never forget it. Relief crashed over him like a wave, but underneath it I could see something heavier. Shame, maybe, or sorrow for what he had to tell. "She's inside," he said before Perseus could even ask. "She's safe. Your mother's here." Perseus started toward the temple, but Dictys caught his arm, held him back. "Wait," he said. "You need to know what happened." And watching Perseus's face as Dictys told him, watching the way his expression went from hope to understanding to something cold and absolute, I knew exactly how this was going to end. I knew what was coming, and I'll be honest with you. I didn't try to stop it. Let me tell you what Dictys said, standing there at the temple entrance with his weathered fisherman's hands gripping Perseus's arm like he was afraid the boy might blow away. Polydectes had spent every day of Perseus's absence hunting Dana. At first, it was gifts, jewelry, fine cloth, things a fisherman's widow had no use for. Then promises. Marry me, and I'll make you a queen. Marry me, and your son's memory will be honored. Marry me, because I'm asking nicely, and you should be grateful. When she refused, the gifts stopped. The threats began. He made it clear, Dictys told us, standing there with his voice shaking, clear that she could agree or she could watch her life become impossible. He'd turn the whole island against her. No one would sell her fish. No one would speak to her. No one would help. She'd starve or submit. Her choice. Danae chose neither. She ran, claimed sanctuary in Athena's temple, and Dictys went with her. For weeks, they'd been living there, sleeping on stone floors, rationing what little food sympathetic temple servants could sneak to them, praying, waiting, hoping that somehow, against all odds, Perseus would return. I watched Perseus's face while Dictys spoke. I've seen rage before, believe me, I've seen it. My father Ares is rage incarnate, all thunder and roaring and fists through walls. My grandfather Zeus throws lightning when he's annoyed. But this was different. This was cold, quiet, the kind of anger that doesn't need to shout because it already knows exactly what it's going to do. It was the anger of someone who'd crossed the world and killed a monster and survived the impossible, and who was now learning that the real monster had been here all along, tormenting his mother while he was gone. He's having a banquet, Dictys said. Tonight, a celebration, he's telling everyone he's finally won, that Danae will marry him whether she agrees or not. He's invited every lord, every ally, everyone who matters. He wants witnesses. He never thought I'd come back, Perseus said. It wasn't a question. No, Dictys said quietly. He was very sure you were dead. Perseus nodded once. Just once. Then he walked past Dictys into the temple. I followed, not with feet, but the way I do. The way gods move through the world when we want to see something up close. The temple was dim and cool. Danae was kneeling before Athena's statue, and when she heard footsteps, she turned, probably expecting a servant or a priest. Instead, she saw her son. I won't tell you everything that happened when they embraced. Some moments are too private, even for me. But I will tell you this. She held him like he was still that baby in the wooden chest, the one she'd wrapped in her own cloak to keep him warm while they drifted on the open sea. And he held her like he was the man he'd become, the one who could finally, finally protect her. When they pulled apart, her eyes went to the leather bag he carried, the one stained with old blood, tied shut with careful knots. You did it, she whispered. You actually did it. I brought him his gift, Perseus said. His voice was flat, empty, just like he asked. That's when Andromeda stepped forward from the doorway. She'd been watching, silent, and I saw her face change as she understood what was about to happen. This wasn't the young man who'd joked with her during the flight home, who'd told her stories about growing up on a fishing boat. This was someone else, someone who could seal his heart away when he needed to. Someone who'd learned over these long months of traveling and killing and surviving how to become exactly as hard as the world required. She didn't try to stop him. I'm not sure anyone could have. When's the banquet? Perseus asked. It's already started, Dictys said from the doorway. The sun's almost down. He'll be drunk by now. They all will be. Good, Perseus said. He kissed his mother's forehead, told Andromeda to stay with her, told Dictys to wait. Then he walked out of the temple alone, carrying that leather bag, and I went with him. Let me tell you what it's like when flesh becomes stone. There's no thunder, no lightning strike, no crack of divine power splitting the air. That's what mortals always expect. Some grand pronouncement from the heavens, some sign that the world is changing. But Medusa's curse doesn't work that way. It's silent. Perseus pulled the head free of the cloth, careful, so careful, keeping his own eyes averted, and held it up for Polydectes to see. I watched the king's face. For one single heartbeat, he didn't understand what he was looking at. His eyes went to the snakes first. They were still moving, even dead, writhing in Medusa's hair like they had their own life separate from hers. Then his gaze traveled down to her face, to those eyes that had turned 1,000 men to stone, and understanding. His expression froze. That cruel, triumphant smirk he'd been wearing became permanent, carved into granite. His fingers, gripping the chair arms, went gray and hard. His chest, halfway through drawing breath, stopped. 2 heartbeats. Maybe 3. That's all it took. The man beside him had been lifting his cup to drink. The wine never reached his lips. He became a statue of thirst, forever reaching for something he'd never taste. Another man had been laughing at some joke. He was still laughing, mouth open, head thrown back, caught in mirth he could no longer feel. All around the room it spread like ripples in a pond. Men turned to see what the commotion was about, and in turning, in seeing, they sealed their fate. Some of them tried to look away. You could see it in the angle of their necks, the tension in their shoulders, the way their hands came up too late to shield their eyes. But stone is faster than fear. One by one, all around that hall, Polydectes' court became monuments to their own curiosity. A man frozen mid-stride, running for the door he'd never reach. Another with his hand on his sword hilt, halfway to drawing a blade that would stay sheathed forever. Two men who'd been leaning close in conversation, now locked together for eternity in their conspiracy. I stood there, invisible, intangible, but there, and watched it happen. Watched an entire room full of living, breathing, cruel men become a garden of statues. Watched power and privilege and casual cruelty turn to rock in the space of a few heartbeats. And I'll tell you something I've never told anyone. I felt no pity. I should have, maybe. I'm supposed to be the goddess of harmony, of balance, of bringing opposing forces into peace. But these men had spent months enabling Polydectes, laughing while he hunted Danae, drinking his wine while she starved in a temple. They'd watched him send a boy to his death and called it sport. Now they were stone, forever. Polydectes would never move from that chair, would never taste wine again, never force another woman, never send another boy to die. He'd sit there, frozen in the moment he realized he wasn't untouchable after all, until time and weather wore him to dust. It seemed fair to me. Perseus stood in the center of it all, Medusa's head still held high, and for a long moment he just looked around at what he'd done. His face was very calm, very still, like he'd gone somewhere deep inside himself where the enormity of it couldn't quite reach him yet. Then, carefully, so carefully, he began wrapping the head again. He drew the cloth over those terrible eyes first, covered the snakes, now sluggish, confused by the sudden absence of targets, folded the fabric around her face, her neck, the ragged edge where Perseus had cut through, slipped it all back into the leather bag, pulled the drawstring tight, tied it with knots that would hold, made it safe again. The danger passed. The curse was contained. The hall was utterly silent. No breathing, no heartbeats, no rustle of clothing or creak of chairs or clink of cups. Just stone and shadows and the soft flicker of torches that would burn down to nothing while their former holders stood frozen forever. Perseus looked around one more time, taking it in. Memorizing it, maybe, or saying goodbye to the boy he'd been when he walked in here. Then he turned and walked out. I followed him into the cool evening air. He made it about 20 steps from the palace entrance before he stopped, bent over, and was sick in the bushes. His hands were shaking when he straightened up, shaking so badly he had to press them against his thighs to make them stop. "I killed them," he said to the empty air. To me, maybe, though he couldn't see me. To himself. "I killed them all. Yes, I wanted to say, you did, and they deserved it, but I didn't speak." Because he needed to wrestle with this himself, needed to figure out what it meant to have that kind of power, to use it, to live with it afterward. He stood there for a long time, breathing hard, staring at nothing. Then Andromeda was there. She must have followed him from the temple. She didn't say anything, just came and stood beside him, close enough that their shoulders touched. "Are they?" she asked quietly. "Yes," he said. "Good," she said, and that simple word, that fierce, final good, seemed to steady him. He took a deep breath, stood up straighter, picked up the bag he'd dropped. "Come on," he said. "My mother needs to know she's safe." They walked back to the temple together, and I watched them go. Behind them, the palace stood silent. A tomb full of tyrants who'd never learned that power without mercy turns to stone in the end, one way or another. "Come closer. Let me tell you something. You've probably heard that Perseus lived happily ever after, that he married Andromeda, settled down, became a king himself eventually, founded cities, had children, grew old, surrounded by people who loved him. And it's true. All of that happened, but not yet. First, there was one more thing. One more terrible, unavoidable thing that had been waiting for him since before he was born, since before his mother was locked in that bronze chamber. since the moment his grandfather heard a prophecy and decided he could outrun fate. You can't outrun fate. I've watched mortals try for thousands of years, and it never works. The more you twist and turn to avoid it, the more surely you walk straight into its arms. Acrisius, Perseus's grandfather, the king who'd locked Danae away, who'd sealed her and baby Perseus in a chest and thrown them into the sea, he was still out there. Still alive. Still afraid. He'd heard the prophecy. Your daughter's son will kill you. And he'd spent Perseus's entire life running from it. Hiding from it, checking every stranger's face, starting at every shadow, waiting for the grandson he'd tried to murder to come for revenge. But here's the thing about prophecies. They don't care about revenge. They don't care about intentions or justice or whether you deserve what's coming. They just are. Like gravity. Like time. Like the way autumn always follows summer, no matter how much you wish it wouldn't. Perseus didn't want to kill his grandfather, didn't even know where Acrisius was, didn't spend his nights plotting vengeance or sharpening his sword. He just wanted to live his life. But fate had other plans. There were games, you see. Athletic competitions in Larissa, far from Seraphos. Discus throwing, wrestling, running. The kind of things young men do to prove themselves, to show their strength, to win glory. Perseus was good at the discus. Strong arms from all those years helping Dictys pull in nets. Good aim from throwing stones at seabirds when he was a boy. Just good enough to do something terrible by accident. I was there. I watched it happen. And I'll tell you about it. About the games and the throw and the old man in the crowd who'd been running his whole life and finally stopped in exactly the wrong place at exactly the wrong moment. I'll tell you how prophecies come true even when nobody wants them to. How fate finds you even when you're not looking for it. How sometimes the worst things we do are the ones we never meant to do at all. But not tonight. Tonight, let Perseus sleep in that temple with his mother safe and his enemies turned to stone and his future bride breathing softly nearby. Let him have this one peaceful night before the last piece of his story falls into place. Let him dream about building a life instead of running from a prophecy. He's earned that much. Tomorrow, or the next day, or the day after that, the discus will fly, the old king will fall. The prophecy will close like a book that's been open since before Perseus was born. But tonight, he gets to rest. And so do you. I'll see you soon, my friend, when you're ready to hear how it all ends. Sweet dreams, much love. I am Harmonia. Oh, before you go, one more thing. Traveler, if you enjoyed our time together in the halls of Olympus, there's a gift you can give in return. Just a little thing. Leave a 5-star rating and share this podcast with a friend or whisper it to the wind. The gods love a good rumor. And if you're curious about the mortal world, its twists, its triumphs, its tangled histories, come find me in my other podcast, History's Arrow. There, we follow the path of humanity, one story at a time. Until next time, walk wisely, speak kindly, and never underestimate the power of a good story. Your friend, Harmonia. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 4.0 international. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.